What's it like to live in another country? What's it like to be a stranger, an alien? That's what we've been talking about this Easter season. Peter's six readings in Peter's epistle to a group of believers living in Asia Minor, a group of churches in what is now Turkey, telling them what it is, how it is to live as a stranger. Not an alien or a stranger because you're from one country and you're in another country, but in a spiritual sense, right? Living here in this world, in this society, in this culture. We've noted that Peter mentions to his readers that there is a sense of not fitting in, not belonging, not being in sync with the rest of the culture. Reading this text this week, I was reminded of a story. Now, what I remember about high school is that I was always tired. I was always beat, man. I don't know why, you know. I don't know if I was staying up too late or what was going on. But I just remember it seemed like I was so tired every day. And, you know, you had to get up early. You get up at like 6 and you had to walk to the bus stop. And then you get on the bus and then you had a 30-minute bus ride. And then you get there and they're still not ready. I mean, it's just, I don't know. And one particular day, I think I was around, 16 years old. It was a very warm, sunny afternoon in high school, after lunch, no doubt. And no air conditioning in those days, right? And just got really sleepy, put my head down on the desk, and I was out. I don't know how long I was sleeping. I woke up and people were looking at me and smiling and laughing, and I woke up in the middle of some poetry class. Somebody was reciting Shakespeare or something. I just put my head back down and went back to sleep. And that describes my total relationship up to this time with poetry. No, actually, lately I have tried to really discipline myself, and poetry has been something that it always seemed really hard. And I found out, well, yeah, it is hard. You know, it's supposed to be hard. And if you find a poem, there's about 20 people who are going to write a commentary and tell you what the poet was saying. Yes. And they all say something different. And a lot of the poets, their lives were so messed up anyway that, you know. So it is really hard. I was right about that. So the last several years, I have really made an attempt. Now, I'm not going to drop names or read any poems to you or any of that. So don't get worried, you know. But I really have made an attempt to study it and make it like a part of study. And it is, I find that it's like calisthenics for your brain, you know. It sort of changes your thinking, changes things and the way you look, and it's been a great experience. And it's helped me with the scriptures and how, I mean, so much of the Bible is poetry. It's really helped me. And that brings me to Peter's letter. Because this little text that we have in front of us is quite a piece of writing. It really is. It's quite a piece of literature. I mean, it is filled with imagery and different metaphors, and different allusions and descriptions. I mean, you have the infant longing for her mother's milk. You have a movement from darkness to light. And then there's something called a living stone. A living stone? What is that? How can a stone be alive? A building. The metaphor of God's people as a building, a temple, the priesthood, the holy nation, the household, the family, the actual dwelling place of God. Taste and see that the Lord is good. He hits on, you know, the senses. Taste and see, he says. Taste and see. It's like You want the pure milk. And also, he brings up the doctrine which, you know, we don't like it. It makes us nervous. We're not really going to go into that today. But this doctrine of election. Three times in this little text, Peter uses the word chosen. And so he's getting pretty deep theologically here. Six out of the nine verses are Old Testament quotes. And so you add all of these things to the actual quality and style of the Greek language, and it's no wonder that many people actually will say, Peter, there's no way he wrote this. This is way beyond him. But we are going to go with the fact that it is Peter. It is his letter. Now you remember Peter. You know, what do you remember about him? His occupation, right? He was a fisherman. He was a blue-collar guy. He was a work-with-his-hands guy. At one point, they made fun of his speech because he was from Galilee. And, you know, he was saying things like yins and that, or I don't know. But they were making fun of his speech. At another point in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, they make fun of his preaching. Who is this guy? You don't have an education. The Pharisees said to him, you don't have theological training. And they made fun of that when he started to preach. Peter is a guy that classic sticks his foot in his mouth, right? Classic example of someone who speaks before thinking. I mean, he's always blurting stuff out. Continually through the Gospels. He's impulsive. He cuts off the ear of Malchus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Very impulsive. Speaks before thinking. He's actually comes across as a little dull. They're at the Lord's Supper and Jesus is washing their feet, and Peter says, no, you're not washing mine. And Jesus says, if I don't wash your feet, you have no part of me. Oh, wash all of me then, Peter says. And Jesus says, no, you don't all. And, you know, so there's this back and forth, and you think in a sense, you know, Peter, just shut up, okay? You're not getting it. Peter is the one who cowered at the servant girl and denied the Lord three times, and even to convince them, he cursed so that they would believe he wasn't a follower. That's the Peter that we get, but now we're 30 years beyond all of that. And wow, how did he get here? How, and it's not just the writing, which I was really focusing on, it's not just the writing, but in his understanding of who Jesus is, his boldness in his preaching, to be able to stand up and to address the leaders, and they said, you can't speak about Jesus, and he says, we're going to obey God, we're not going to obey you. To the leaders, his patience and love for others, this person who was always trying to be the first one, always trying to be ahead of the pack. Humility. It's a remarkable transformation. And he's going to tell us how it happened. He's going to tell us how to get there. What life can be like now. We know that we have a resurrection ahead of us. We know that we have an inheritance kept in heaven that is reserved, that cannot be contaminated. But Peter is going to talk about, no, right now, in this place, in this present culture, things can be remarkably different because you are the new people of God. And so it's really a tale, I think, in this chapter, what I've called is a tale of two homes. It's a tale of two places to live. I like how someone has translated verse 11. He says, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which war against the soul. One person translates that you are a people living outside the house of the dominant culture. You are a people living outside of the house of the dominant culture. You're not at home in it. And so therefore, there are some things that you are going to have to do away with. There are some things that you are going to have to change if you're not going to be in that house. Right? And he names them. The passions of the flesh, the passions that war against your soul. That's concerning me. The other thing is concerning how I treat you. Put away malice, deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander. One is instructions to myself. The other is how I live with others. Living in this house or outside of their house, this is what it's going to take. And later on in chapter 4, he says, you know, that here's the thing about the people around you that are watching you because you're not involved with them. He says, they're in chapter 4, he says, they're surprised at you because you don't go with them to their little parties and their orgies and their debauchery and their drunkenness and all the stuff that they're doing. He says, they're actually watching you and they're surprised. And not only that, but they're maligning you. And we're going to find out also that persecution is involved in that. But that is life in one place, one house, outside of that house. You're not joining in with them. You're living outside of the house of the dominant culture. But the other one, he says, right? What does he say? Living stones are being built up as a spiritual house. A spiritual house. That's where we live, in this spiritual house. And what does that look like? What happens in this home that we live in? The spiritual home that is in the midst of everything else. Well, here is a place that Christians receive spiritual nourishment. Taste and see that the Lord is good. He says one of the things that when you think about a changed life, a different way to live, it's a longing, a yearning for the pure spiritual milk. Now what is that? What is that? Most people believe, and that's quite an image, right? Because you get that, who hasn't seen or been around a baby that, wow, you know, how important that is. My mother always still tells me, it's a little embarrassing, but she'll say, Dave, when you were a baby, she says, you chugged that milk down so hard that you broke out in a sweat on your forehead. She still tells me that, you know, 65 years later. But that's the way they are, you know, that's the way my grandson is, that's the way he is when he's around his mama. Boy, there's a yearning, a longing. I gotta get to that milk. What an image Peter gives us. It's a longing for God, a longing for His Word, the living Word that gives life. It's a longing for His presence, for His justice. That's part of what it is to live in this house and to be changed like Peter. The second thing is that there you're going to be nourished and you're going to grow. You're going to grow. This is actually a house where there is building going on. That's why Peter is, 30 years later, he's not at all the same Peter that he used to be. Not at all. It's plain to see. Not just in his writing, but in many ways. Because there is a growing, there is a maturing, there is a building that is going on in this spiritual house that is made up not of the bricks that we have at St. Albans, but of the people, the followers of Jesus, living stones, the building. And this is the place where God dwells in this house. It's much different than the other house. In this one, There is light, not darkness. In this one, there is mercy. You were a people that did not have mercy. Now you have mercy. You were a people that were in darkness. Now you have light. He says, you know what? You weren't even a people. You didn't really have anything. And now you're a chosen people. And you know what? Back then, and these other folks, they don't really have meaning. They don't really have purpose. But you know what? You are my chosen possession. Chosen before all time. Now, there is light where there was darkness. There is mercy where there wasn't mercy. There is meaning and purpose where there wasn't. Now you're special. You're special in this house. Something is being built because of the resurrection. Right now, today, something is being built. That's why Peter was so different. Who knows what could happen? Who knows what could happen? And I heard a great story this week from our family. Our nephew, who is 60, he just took a new church in Florida. He's only been there about a month, an evangelical free church in Florida. And last Sunday, he said he was preaching. He's up there preaching. And as he's preaching, he kept getting this feeling in his mind, in his heart, that he needed to tell a particular story about something that happened in his youth, in his childhood. Really, he really hadn't planned on it, wasn't, you know, part of anything, but he said, I'm preaching, and it just kept coming, it just kept coming. Tell this story. So he told a story. And it's a story of growing up in a certain town as a youth, and he moved around a lot. His father was a pastor, and he had a friend who lived down the street, and this friend had a very troubled family. And the dad would come home, would drink, and come home, and very violent, you know, would beat the children. Violence to his wife, even, you know, bringing the guns out. I mean, terrible, terrible stuff in his friend's house. And so what this family would do is that because, and this is a great illustration of houses, right? Because there was this chaos in their house and this mess in their house, which I think Peter is trying to tell us about the present culture, they would go down the street and seek refuge in the Nazarene church, in God's house. Right, you got these two houses in the culture. And they would get down the street and seek refuge in that church to get away from what was going on up in their own home. Well, what happened was that mother and those children actually came to Christ. You know, going to that church and being a part of that church and hearing the gospel, they actually came to Christ. And then, lo and behold, guess what else? The father. Became a Christian. Things started to change. And then, you know, you can imagine that change. Well, our nephew said that after the sermon, he just got to the church and doesn't know everybody. You know, a church about our size. And he was done preaching. He was greeting people. And a woman came up to him and said, I am one of those kids. I grew up in that house. And my mother is here today. I brought her. The house where God dwells in us as living stones. And the possibilities are boundless. Amen.